You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach talking American League East. We'll be talking with Orioles broadcaster Jim Hunter about Bud Norris, Chris Tillman, and the rest of the Orioles rotation, as well as checking in on Matt Wieters. And then we'll be talking to MLB.com's AL East beat writers. We'll be talking Red Sox, talking about the draft, about Rick Porcello, David Ortiz, and Hanley Ramirez. Talking draft about the Yankees and taking a look at Andrew Miller's injury. We check in on the Rays, more draft, and also a look at that starting rotation. And talking Toronto Blue Jays, again, more of that this week's draft, plus taking a look at Aaron Sanchez and Edwin Encarnacion. Bill, the Rays had a high draft pick for once and took a guy named Garrett Whitley, who seemed like an awfully intriguing player with some questions about the competition level. What is it that they like about Garrett Whitley?
Well, they like, first of all, this guy's he's got great makeup and he's very athletic. Any concerns, in fact, going into the draft, R.J. Harrison, the scouting director, was telling me that one of the things you look at in these guys up north where some of the competition level they play at is not quite as developed as, you know, some of the guys you might see in some of the hot weather states. For example, you might not see a guy who, you know, you might not see a guy who throws 90 miles an hour while you're playing in high school. But this Whitley kid, you know, he played in a lot of the showcases, and those are the events that they put on for the different, top prospects. And so they get to play against some of the others. And he said they just kept noticing every time he would line up, he seemed to get better. And even Whitley said he'd never seen 90 miles per hour probably before until he was in one of those showcases. But he adjusted. And of course, the biggest risk you have in any kind of a draft is taking offensive players, because you just don't know how they're going to adjust hitting-wise to better pitching. So, it's kind of nice. They've already seen him adjust, you know, from, you know, mid-80s, probably what he's looking at up northeast, to, these 90-mile-per-hour guys in these showcases. So they feel pretty good about him, and they were very happy that he was around.
What is their confidence level as far as signing him?
Well, they seem pretty confident about him, and you know, they keep kind of a poker face. Normally when you talk to some of the kids, you hear more about maybe what's going on. For example, Whitley sounded like he was ready to get going, whereas their second pick, Chris Betts, he sounded like, he explained to us that there was a negotiating process. So they leave the draft once it's over, though, and they get with the scouts do, trying to sign as many of these guys as they can as quickly as they can, because it really is invaluable for their progress is to get them in the system right away instead of waiting till later in the summer.
They took a couple of players, one of whom you just mentioned, with some injury questions, Chris Betts and Brandon Lowe. Are there significant worries, or are they pretty confident those guys are going to be healthy and good to go, no problems moving forward?
They sounded like, they were, these guys were checked out and they were, fine with what their progress was. I know Betts was a pretty highly thought of catcher, and they got him with, I believe it was the 52nd pick, which, probably shouldn't have come to them. He was slotted probably about 25. But he'd had a forearm problem. A lot of times, as Rays fans know, forearm problems a lot of times lead to elbow surgery. So, but he's, been progressing. He ended up his last 3 weeks of high school ball. He had DH'd for his team out in Long Beach. But he seemed to indicate that things were going well. And, again, their only problem with him seems to me maybe, he's got leverage between them and the University of Tennessee.
This was a pretty huge draft for the Rays, just because a lot of times in recent years they have not had the kind of high pick they win, and so you pick lower. This is a real opportunity for a club that built itself on the draft to kind of restock. When you look at the overall product, you look at the overall 3 days of the draft, is there anything to be gleaned sort of philosophically or strategically about what they did in the 2015 draft overall?
Well, I noticed, and I, and this is one of those where I did not compare the numbers to it, but it seemed like they took a lot more position players than they've had in the past, more position players and more college players. And, you know, you look at the game today, there's so much more demand for offense that, you know, it seems like they're running these guys in more or hoping to have some more help offensively than maybe what they've drafted in the past. I know I wrote about this one kid, Matt Dacey, from Richmond, too. He kind of stuck out to me. His offense, you know, they got him with their 21st pick. 17 home runs at the University of Richmond. You know, big power potential. That's, you know, it's like a fighter with a knockout punch. You know, you know he's got that. Now, if he can, you know, make those adjustments hitting-wise, which we talked about with Whitley, and he can show that he, you know, is not a total plumber in the field, you know, they might have, had, you know, had a plum there. And, of course, it can happen. You know, they, you know, think about Kevin Kiermaier. They got him in the 31st round. So, you know, just, you know, bring him in. You know, you got to sign the guy and see what happens.
To shift over to the Major League roster, yet another Rays starting pitcher goes on the DL. What's there to be said about Jake Odorizzi's situation?
From what I understand, they're not – I mean, he did go on the DL, but these oblique injuries can be – you know, the degree of them can be really bad to not so bad. And from what I'm gathering, his is not so bad. Now, how long it takes him to come back and start, you know, being up to full speed again, whether that's in, you know, how many innings he can throw or if he can actually pitch in a major league game, you know, we'll wait and see. But, you know, I think they felt like they got him, I believe it was last Saturday when it happened, and they got him out in time. Maybe it's Friday, I can't remember, but they got him out in time before he really hurt himself. So, I think that one sounds like they can be a little more positive about it. But then again, the Rays are very conservative with any of these injuries, so you know, let's wait and see.
Meanwhile, Matt Moore continues to progress. I'm assuming he's on still the same time frame that we've been talking about for a while here, but are they starting to get excited about what they're seeing from him in these rehab starts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as much as they carry on about that, you know, basically the main thing they're excited about is that, you know, he hasn't had any setbacks. I know he told reporters yesterday that he's pretty happy about being out there and being more into what's happening in the game instead of worrying about what's happening with his arm. And I think that's part of the progression in the rehab is getting to where you forget about having been injured and you get back to your normal paces. So, you know, there's a chance, you know, he could be back here pretty soon.
Then one kind of big picture question. This team is now 1.5 out. They are right in the middle of it in a division that it appears nobody's even going to run away with. With the acknowledgement that the Rays are virtually never a conventional buyer or a conventional seller. And so I understand that, you know, they're not going to trade four prospects for Cole Hamels and they're not going to do the sort of typical stuff. But is this team in a position where it is likely to be, in some sense, a buyer over the next 7 or 8 weeks as the trade deadline approaches, as they're right in the middle of a playoff hunt?
I think that's certainly a possibility. But as you, you know, like to say, they usually shop at, you know, they don't shop at Brooks Brothers. They buy their clothes at Target. I mean, they look for good value. A lot of times it's a wily reliever like they did with Chad Bradford a while back. I think to think more in pieces that can help them instead of, you know, huge makeover type pieces or might, you know, guys that might carry on, you know, in years to come. I think that's the kind of guys that normally they're you know, in the market for. And, you know, it might be some guy they can bring off the bench, you know, a good bat, or it might be a bullpen piece, or who knows, it might be a fifth starter, or, you know, some fifth starter who can just give them five innings, because that's something that's going to wear on them as the time goes on, even if Moore comes back anytime soon. I, I don't expect him to be giving him a lot of innings. So I definitely think they could be in the buyer's market, but I do think it's going to be at the bargain bin.
All right. Well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Brian, the Yankees for a second consecutive year drafted a guy who the perception is could be a quick mover and maybe even a very quick mover. Is that your understanding of James Caprillion, that he could be a guy, one of the first guys from this draft class to see the major leagues?
Yeah, they like him a lot. As with Jacob Lindgren last year, who was their number one pick, or their first overall pick, they think he can move very quickly. Lindgren was a little bit different situation. He was a college reliever, and that tends to accelerate the process. I think he had something like 45 innings in the minor leagues, and then he already made it to Yankee Stadium. Caprillion's probably not going to move that quickly, but they see him as a solid number three type starter going forward. So a year or two from now, it would not be a big surprise to see James Caprillion as part of the Yankees rotation, competing to be part of that rotation. The Yankees believe they're going to work out an agreement with him. He's represented by Scott Boras, so, you know, it could take a little while, but they think by the end of the summer they should have him in uniform and he can get started moving toward the big leagues.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting idea because on the one hand, he seems to be that sort of – there's a certain type of kind of college pitcher who come out relatively ready-made and maybe slide into the middle or back of somebody's rotation right away. But at the same time, this is a club that might could use a reliever in the short term. Is there any challenge to sort of managing that those seemingly somewhat disparate pairs of expectations?
It's always something you could do. For example, you could move him to the bullpen, and he would probably get to the big leagues quicker. And if you had a need for that, you could do it. But they have some other candidates at the high AAA level, Luis Severino, Brian Mitchell. Those guys also fit into that, and they've got a little more polish on them. One of the comparisons that was thrown around about Caprillion was Ian Kennedy, and I brought that up to Damon Oppenheimer, who is the director of amateur scouting for the Yankees. He said, not really. He said that comparison gets thrown around a lot because they're both from Southern California, both, you know, similar kind of pitchers, but not really. But, you know what, suffice it to say, if people are looking at him and seeing Ian Kennedy, the Yankees would take that absolutely because that's a major league pitcher. That's a guy who could fit in your rotation. And obviously they had Ian Kennedy at one point, and he's still kicking around the big leagues. But, you know, the Yankees probably hope that Caprillion's a little better than Ian Kennedy, and I think that's certainly in play.
Their second pick I thought was a really interesting pick, a profile that maybe you don't necessarily often take quite that high. Kyle Holder, big league glove and questionable stick. Do they think he's going to hit? I mean, do they think that he will hit enough to be the kind of player that you're glad you took at that point in the draft?
They do. I was talking to Oppenheimer last night after the draft, and he was kind of unwinding a little bit, and I mentioned how people on social media weren't thrilled with the Holder pick, and he said that did not sync up at all with what the Yankees had heard. Matter of fact, Oppenheimer said of all the picks that the Yankees made in the draft, the one he got the most comments from scouts, cross-checkers, people in the game, people with other clubs, said that Holder was a great pick at 30. So we'll see what happens, but the one comparison he did mention, he said people in the Yankee organization have referred to Omar Vizquel when evaluating Holder's defense. That's pretty good. You take that. And he did hit, I believe, over 340 in a pretty competitive league this past year. So the skills may be there. I think, they've been burned before on guys like Cito Culver, who was a number one pick and didn't really pan out and didn't get there. But the Yankees in the post-Derek Jeter era, they're clearly doubling down. They're trying to find somebody who can be the franchise shortstop for years to come. And if he winds up being a defense-first guy like a Brennan Ryan or something at the big league level, you probably take that. Those guys have value as well, and they can hang around the big leagues for quite a while.
One thing you noted in your coverage of the Yankee draft, I believe the exact phrase you used was predictability over upside. Did that just happen, or was that to some extent a strategic thing?
Yeah, how you talk to these evaluators every year, and what they say is we're going to take the best available player on the board regardless of need. But I think that Caprillion is a fairly safe pick. Look, they could have gone after Brady Aiken, who is a guy who has had injury problems. Obviously, the Astros had him once upon a time and didn't work out. They could have gone that route, but you're going for something that's a little more of a safe bet. This is the highest Yankees pick that they've had since 1993. They burned that one on Matt Drews, a guy who never got to the big leagues. But there was some pressure on the organization to get a guy in the early rounds here who can get to Yankee Stadium in the very near future. And they feel like they've got that. I think that saying predictability over upside, yeah, maybe you're not getting a surefire Hall of Famer, although who knows? You know, these things can always work out differently, but what the Yankees feel like they got is they got some bona fide major league talent of the future in this draft, and they seem to feel pretty confident in it. You hear similar things every year, but they're saying them again this year. So until these players get in the system and start proving themselves otherwise, you have to kind of go with that.
To shift gears to the big league club, Andrew Miller goes on the disabled list. Forearm is one of those scary words. They're saying it's a muscle. There certainly can be routine forearm injuries. What is the worry level over Miller right now?
I think it's measured, but this is certainly something that you didn't want to have to deal with. I mean, Miller's been dominant lights out, and I think it calls into question now the usage. Were these guys overused? Has Dellin been overused? I think that Betances' numbers are indicating that he's due for a rest here as well. They're going to have to be careful, but I understand the temptation. Betances and Miller have been so lights out dominant that you kind of have that break in case of emergency button to push, and it's not, they haven't been shy about it. From what I'm hearing right now, it's looking like 3 weeks for Miller. So it'll be a little more than the 15 days, but they don't think it'll be too much more than that. But you're right. Anytime you start hearing about forearm strains and this kind of stuff, you take a step back and you say, uh-oh, better let that cool off. And that's what the Yankees are doing. They're going to have him rest, and he won't pick up a ball for 10 days, and then they'll try it again from there.
Betances presumably obviously slides into the ninth. Is there any shuffling that happens either in terms of roles or roster in front of that part of the bullpen?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is Girardi has been saying all along he didn't expect them to go with five left-handers, and you're seeing the changes there. Obviously, you delete Miller, and they're going to call Chris Martin back from AAA. And Martin made the opening day roster. He looked pretty good in spring training, ran into some trouble, but he'll be back in the mix there. And I think spots are probably up for grabs. I think that Jacob Lindgren got a chance here. He gave up the two-run homer in the game the other day. You're going to still see him, I believe. They're trying to figure this out on the fly, but clearly it's been depleted from what they went into opening day with. You also thought we're going to have David Carpenter in that mix too, and that didn't work out at all. So I think the Yankees are adjusting to some things that were unexpected. Certainly they didn't expect Carpenter to struggle as much as he did. They didn't expect Miller to go on the DL. So they're going to try and figure it out, but the good thing is they still have Betances there, and you can call on him for more than three outs if you have to.
Brennan Ryan steps in, and you know I'm going to have to ask about Brennan Ryan because I'm a Brennan Ryan fan. Gets activated and shows a little bit with the stick. Now, look, I know there are no illusions about what Brennan Ryan can do offensively, but at this point there may not be many illusions about what Stephen Drew can do offensively either. Is there an opportunity for Ryan to play himself and do something more than just defensive caddy?
I don't see it, and here's why. Every time you're ready to cash in on Stephen Drew and say, all right, it's just not going to happen, he'll go out and have a two-homer game, and I think that buys him a little extra time. So I think they're going to stick with Drew at second base. I think Ryan could get some at-bats here, but I think he's pretty well set into what the Yankees know he is. You know, the greatest thing about Brendan Ryan is he finally escaped Florida. He'd been down there since March, and he shows up the other day with a full mustache, and it was almost like, hey, guys, this is still a thing, right? Like, we're still doing this? And it's like, no. And Jacoby Ellsbury walked by and said, does this guy even watch the games? Brendan Ryan is his own character, man. He's fun to have around. I think the Yankee clubhouse would be a little lighter, but as far as contributions with the bat, I wouldn't go expecting a whole lot out of him. You take what you can get. Contributions are welcome, but I think he's very clearly in that backup role, and he can excel at that.
One more move the Yankees just made. Mason Williams gets called up. He was, not that long ago, a really highly regarded prospect. He fell off. He's been hitting pretty well now. What's it fair to expect of him?
Yeah, I think he's rebuilt his stock. He was one of those guys that they were looking at to be in the future at Yankee Stadium, a center fielder of the future, and this is obviously pre-Jacoby Ellsbury, all that. But, yeah, no, he's back on the radar now. He's being rewarded for it. So I think what you're going to see is you're going to see Mason Williams starting in center field. They're going to move Brett Gardner back to left field, and at least against right-handed pitching, that's the way they're going to run it. But I think over the next few weeks, you're going to see a lot of Mason Williams. And, you know, as with Slade Heathcott earlier in the year, I said that Yankee fans were going to like a lot of the way that Heathcott played. Obviously, he got hurt very quickly, but he did play well in a short spurt. I think Williams is that same kind of guy, especially defensively. You're accustomed to seeing Ellsbury and Gardner chase down balls and make good plays, and I think Mason Williams can step right in, and you're not going to miss too much of a beat there.
Sometimes it's difficult to identify exactly why a team is going well or going poorly. Something really stands out, though, about what's gone on here for the Orioles lately. They haven't given up more than 3 runs in a game in over a week, which is a pretty good way to win some games. Is this more or less kind of the way they expect and want to win when they're going to win games? They can hit home runs, but I think this team is maybe kind of built to win 4-2 rather than 7-5.
Well, the pitching certainly has come on, Matthew. It struggled a bit with consistency in April, although they did have a 500 month in April going 10-10. But really, since May the 1st, the starters in particular have done a very good job of getting deeper in games, and that's always a key because you can't overload a bullpen, especially in the AL East. The games within the division are such grind-out games. But I would disagree with the premise that you just mentioned because the Orioles, when they score 4 or more runs, that's the magic number. So the pitchers give them a chance, and then the hitters come through. I totally agree with you. They are built for the big inning. They do live by the home run. But as of late, they've been manufacturing a few more runs. In fact, in this Red Sox series, they've won the first 2 games without hitting a home run. So the pitching is without a doubt a key, and they've been able to navigate with Bud Norris going on the DL, and it looks like Miguel Gonzalez is going on the DL. The depth in the system is now at a point where they do have options. You know, Mike Wright came up. Tyler Wilson came up. These are legitimate options and very much a part of the future with the pitching, but they're there now. So, yeah, the pitching, I agree, it's totally there. But this is still a play for the big inning team. And they love those crooked number innings, and they sure do love the long ball.
You mentioned Norris, and the numbers look good, his return. What did you see from him last time out?
Well, when he pitched Sunday in Cleveland, he finally had command of his pitches. For whatever reason, and really going all the way back to spring training, he did not have a good spring for what he was expecting coming off a 15-win season a year ago. But he just couldn't command his fastball. And when that happens, the hitters tend to get ahead in counts, and they can become more selective, and then they sit on a pitch, and it's harder to get guys out. But the time he spent on the DL, and he was out almost a month. It was just a few days shy of a month. He was able to regain his health. The bronchitis really hit him hard. He lost about 10 pounds. And he had to regain his strength, and in particular, regain the strength in the legs. The legs are so important for a pitcher, and especially a starting pitcher who's hoping to go 5, 6, 7, hopefully 8 innings in a game. And in his start in Cleveland on Sunday, his command was there, and as a result, all of the secondary pitches fell into place. He does have a real good slider, and when he can get ahead of the fastball and have the hitter guessing what's coming or trying to outthink what Bud's doing, he's really good. So hopefully, you don't want to make too much over one start, but he was really good in Cleveland. And the Indians were really swinging the bat when the Orioles went in there over the weekend. And the Birds got 2 out of 3, and the only game they lost 2-1. So that was a real good sign with Bud coming off the DL and getting the Orioles a win in a rubber game to get a series.
You made what I think is an important point about not making too much of one start, and it kind of leads into what I wanted to ask next, which is, going forward here over these next few weeks, what do you think it's fair to expect of Norris, a guy who had such a rough start, was hurt, but is coming off a real good year? It seems like he's still kind of a big variable. What do you think it's fair to expect from him as we go forward?
I think actually he will be able to build off the start. He's a real energetic, some might say hyper guy when he takes the mound. He's fidgety, you know, because he cares so much. It's that kind of a personality that he has. And I think the fact that he spent the time on the DL, his last rehab start, it was AAA. It was only four innings, but he was outstanding. And then he carried that over into Cleveland. The fact that he did that, I got to believe, is going to give him enough confidence that he is, in fact, back now, and he can build on that. All year, because of the spring he had, he never really had that stretch where everything came together. And again, you know, with any pitcher, it's all about command. He had the command. Now I got to believe he'll be confident that the command is back, and he should be able to build on this. Now, he's got to face a Yankee team in his next start, and the Yankees are playing pretty well right now, and they're swinging the bats. But still, the pitcher's in control, and if you're on your game, you can shut down good hitting. So that I think the confidence aspect of this with him is something that will enable him to carry it over. But, you know, the Yankees will have a lot to say with that when he starts against them this weekend.
The other guy in that rotation who has been puzzling, I think is fair to say, is Chris Tillman. And, you know, he's gotten a couple of good final results here lately, but he's still walking a lot of guys. That's not what he is when he's good. What do you think is going on? I mean, it's not six or seven, but it's three every time out. What do you think is going on with the number of guys that Chris Tillman is walking?
Well, he has said all year that he has zero command of his secondary pitches, his curveball and his changeup. He's not throwing them enough for strikes to get the hitters to have to respect that. And as a result, when you can't get your secondary pitches close enough to entice the hitter, you become a predictable pitcher, and they just ignore the other pitches and wait for a fastball. And unfortunately, because he very much, for a guy who throws, you know, low to mid-90s, maybe 94 occasionally, he actually pitches backwards quite a bit, where he'll set you up with all the breaking stuff and then come at you with the fastball, as opposed to getting ahead with power and then finessing you. And if he's not throwing the curveball for him is such an important pitch. And he just doesn't know, and I, you know, who knows why it is. I mean, from year to year, this is why, you know, you go out and play a game. He just hasn't had the feel and the command of his curveball as he had the last couple of years. If he can somehow find that, and he works very hard on it in his side sessions, then I think it all falls back into place for him, because he is a guy who generally, as you say, is around the zone. But this year he is not. Now, in one respect, he tries not to give in to hitters, which will lead to a few more walks if you're behind in the count. You know, if you're 3-1 and you'd rather start over with the guy on deck, sometimes pitchers will do that. But it is alarming when the guy who is regarded as the ace of the staff is walking as many as he is, because what I always look at with a starter is how many base runners per nine innings you're allowing. They can't score if they don't get on. And Chris's are way up this year. So it's extra pitches because of the extra base runners per inning that leads to the high pitch counts and the ineffectiveness. But if he can find the feel for that curveball, I think it snaps back into him very, very quickly, because then he is on the offensive as opposed to the hitters being on the offensive.
One last guy I want to ask you about. Matt Wieters, it's very early. I know it's hard to say a lot from a few games, but he has gotten some good results at the plate. Does he look like he's ready to hit big league pitching to you?
Absolutely. And the ironic thing about Matt coming back, he only made one start in spring training, and it was St. Patrick's Day, so it was 3 weeks in. And he had to make one tough throw. There was a swinging bunt, and he had to fire the ball to first. And the next day, he came down with the soreness in the elbow, and that's when they shut him down and began the process all over again. He was in extended spring training, and he played in so many games down there because he was catching every other day once he was able to throw. And you know how it is with guys coming back from elbows. I mean, they kick you out and they go, okay, Matt, we're going to make 15 throws today. And then when the trainer counts to 15, they say, okay, have a nice day. We'll see you tomorrow. And then you build up from that. But he did that for so long, and as a result, he got so many at-bats in extended spring training. And I realized he's pitching against other injured players and minor leaguers who weren't assigned to a full-season affiliate, so it's not exactly what he's seeing now. But the belief is that because he had it probably was 200 at-bats. I mean, that's how often he was getting in games and facing live pitching. Because of that, they feel the timing instantly came back, because it wasn't as if he, you know, went out and played five games at Bowie in Double-A and then had to face Major League pitching. He got so many at-bats that his bat was ready. The question was, when was his arm going to be ready? They wouldn't activate him simply to DH because it would have really hurt the structure of the roster. So the arm came back, and he's catching every other day right now. He DH'd one of the games in Cleveland because he played so well in his debut on Friday. But last night he didn't DH. He sat out. So the timing, based on the way they brought him back after that minor setback in spring training, he's flat out a good hitter. And because he got so many at-bats in spring in that nice, comfortable 98-degree high-humidity Sarasota heat, he hit the ground running and he was ready to go.
Gregor, John Harris seems to be a pretty nice find for the Jays, as low as they got him. Obviously, the club is always going to say that. There's no phrase that people love more on draft day than "we couldn't believe he was still there." But is it your understanding that it was a surprise that John Harris fell all the way to the Blue Jays?
Yeah, I think so. And this was definitely a case where they were genuinely surprised. And, you know, I think all you had to do is really kind of look at all the projections going in. And it's not an exact science by any means, but, you know, Jim Callis and guys like that know exactly what they're talking about. And there was some genuine interest there from teams much higher in the draft. And that's something Harris talked about as well. He talked about a couple of different teams in the top 15 where he thought there was a chance that he might go. So the Blue Jays really did catch a break here. It's a very safe pick for them. And it's a first round talent for a guy that, you know, the Blue Jays lost their pick because of signing Russell Martin. And there's obviously a huge value in that, but you know, they got 29 as compensation for Melky Cabrera, and they made quite good use out of it.
It was kind of a weird first round for college starters in general, actually. There are a couple of guys who maybe fell more than you would have expected. Really, a few guys who fell maybe more than you would have expected. So Harris's fall, do you think it's just something structural, just that teams wanted other things and that he was maybe sort of in a bucket with guys like Buehler and Funkhauser, or was there something about him that clubs saw that maybe scared them off?
No, I think it was exactly that. And it was kind of it was the trend in that draft. And, you know, the Blue Jays are fortunate that they have a very deep scouting department. They have a lot of guys that they can go to. So even though they didn't expect to be able to get someone like Harris, they still had someone at all his starts. Brian Parker was asked that very kind of question after he was taken. Was there a potential reason? And he just said that was the best benefit of having all these guys, that they were able to follow him so that they knew that they didn't see anything had changed, and then that wasn't the reason why he dropped. And so they felt very confident with that pick as well.
Missouri State is not necessarily a place like Rice or Stanford where guys who start there or go there or commit there not only go, but go for 4 years. But at the same time, it's a good baseball program. It's a place where he seems happy. Is there any concern that they might not be able to get this done, or are they confident that they will get Harris under contract?
No, I think they're confident, and I think both sides are very willing to do a deal. I think maybe he was hoping to go a little bit higher and probably get a little bit more money than he can get from the Blue Jays with their total allotment. But I think this is something where both sides are going to be on the same page and quite quickly as well to try and get him into the system as quickly as possible.
Generally, a baseball draft is ultimately is about best player available for a lot of reasons, starting with the fact that most of these guys you don't see for 3 or 4 years anyway. And maybe you'll see a club draft to need once or twice, a club that needs lefties or needs catchers. You'll see a little of that tint. But by and large, a baseball team's draft is just sort of the players who are available. With that said, it seems like there may be an exception with this Blue Jays draft. It looks like there was a plan or a strategy to target some specific needs and categories. Is that an accurate read on what they did over these 3 days?
Yeah, and they also continued to pile up on pitching as well, and there's not necessarily a need for that, because that's something they do have a lot of depth in. The position player is kind of where they needed a little bit more, but they still weren't afraid to top that up as well, and that's because, you know, they've shown a tendency to be willing to trade some of those guys as well. So, you know, they kind of have the same philosophy that a lot of organizations have, which is you can never have enough pitching. So they added that, but then another one that they added was they don't have a lot of power in that organization as well, and it's something that, you know, Parker talked a lot about how there's just not a lot of power in the draft this year, and it's kind of been that way for a little bit, at least in terms of depth. And they got Carl Wise in the fourth round, who was one of the better college power bats available. So they did kind of address a specific need in that area too.
To shift gears over to the big league club, Aaron Sanchez was skipped. Is this purely preventative, or is there some concern over something they're seeing from Sanchez?
No, purely preventative at this point. I think there is some concern about, you know, his overall workload. So it's really to kind of manage his innings, especially as you get later into the year. This isn't a situation where you want to have him shut down at any point in September because of innings or anything like that. And that's not something the organization is going to do if they're contending. But this is one way to kind of monitor that kind of early on. And, you know, I was thinking going into that it probably wasn't the best idea because he had been on a bit of a roll as well. And it also came kind of in the midst of this big winning streak that the team has been on. But Scott Copeland, to his credit, came up and had a great spot starts, so they were able to kind of not miss a beat, even though missing Sanchez, who's really become one of the more dependable guys over the last few weeks.
Yeah, you mentioned he does seem to be kind of showing some encouraging signs, and specifically, he's throwing strikes, which obviously is the big issue. What is it that contributes to this lately where he has been more around the strike zone?
I think it really is just kind of a simple change that he made with Russell Martin, you know, probably about a month ago now, where they just had him, Russell Martin, kind of just set up right down the middle and kind of let the sinker do its work. And he's got a lot of movement on that fastball. When he tries to be a little bit too fine, that's when everything kind of tails out of the strike zone. And that was his biggest issue early on. And so I think they're just letting him show a little bit more inner confidence as well, that he's going to trust his stuff, that, you know, there's not going to be too many pitches that when he throws down the middle, it's going to actually stay there. Most of them are going to have some pretty good movement on that. And so that's been able to kind of cut down his walks a little bit. And then the fact that he's always able to generate a lot of ground balls, he can get away with some of those base runners because he's also been generating a lot of double plays.
As a group, it seems like the Blue Jays starters have really kind of cut down those walks that were really problematic. Overall, what's the kind of level of confidence or encouragement with what they're seeing from the rotation as a group right now?
Well, it's definitely been the biggest positive, and that's, you know, the lineup kind of speaks for itself, and you know the Blue Jays are going to score runs. They don't need perfection from them now, but they need, you know, some reliable quality innings just like any other team. And, you know, they've really been getting that now for quite a long stretch. For the last 3 weeks or so, they've kind of starting to turn things around. And the walks are a big reason why. And you kind of look at each individual kind of example. You know, we talked about Sanchez. Drew Hutchinson's another guy that has been able to cut down on the walks. And you know, there's been some inconsistency there with him recently. But for the most part, he's kind of turned things around after a slow start as well. And then you have R.A. Dickey, who's still trying to, you know, find that consistency from start to start. But we've seen glimpses of it now. And overall, his walks have come down. So really from a group 1 through 5, they've all kind of done a good job with that. And obviously when you have fewer base runners, there's going to be fewer mistakes out there, or it's not going to cost quite as much if you happen to give up that home run. Those three-run shots are now more often becoming solo shots.
There was a little health scare recently with Edwin Encarnacion. He's obviously a guy they need at the heart of that lineup to keep this thrashing machine of an offense going. What is the latest on his health?
Well, the shoulder's a little bit of a concern now. I mean, a week ago it was the leg and the hamstring, and that seems to have rectified itself after he took a series off in Washington. But now the shoulder's kind of become an issue. And, you know, he's a guy who typically does get banged up throughout the course of the season, especially when he's playing as much as he was at first base. That the shoulder injury is a little bit unrelated to that. But, you know, it's not something the Blue Jays are expecting to be long-term, at least right now. But the fact that it's kind of crept up a couple of times now in the last week, even though he was able to hit a walk-off homer in the middle of that, the fact that he's still feeling it is a bit of a concern. So it wouldn't be a total surprise if he needs a little bit more time as well.
Yeah, I mean, how do they manage that? Could you see him proactively getting not just a day but a few days, or how do they kind of handle that?
Yeah, that's probably how they would do it, and that's kind of how they've done it with a few of their other guys. They're going to try to avoid the DL stint if at all possible. I mean, that would be an absolute last resort. They've shown a willingness to go with a short bench for a few games. They've done it for a week at a time earlier this year, and while they don't want to go quite that long, I think they are prepared to take it kind of day by day with him, and especially when you're talking about that big of a bat, you want to give that as much time as possible before, taking any kind of long-term measure with it.
And then one last thing, and it's the kind of thing, splits like this often even out over the course of the year, but the Blue Jays right now have an absolutely enormous home-road split. We've talked some before about how well they hit at home. What do you make of what is a really gaping distance between how they've done at home and how they've done on the road?
Yeah, it's almost an impossible one to answer because it's been hard to figure out. You'd think some of that would – at least normalize a little bit over time. You expect the home numbers to kind of potentially be where they're at. I mean, it's a spot where, the team is kind of built around to compete in that ballpark. But I would expect that to eventually even out a little bit. It just seems to be they've had some very rough road trips this year where they've gone through, and they faced some tough pitching in Washington, and they've had some things there. But I think it'll eventually get back to normal a little bit, but you're always going to, I think with this team, with the power and everything, you're always still going to see at least a little bit splits to the home side.
Ian, the Red Sox took a player in the first round of the draft that I personally just love. Saw him play in the SEC down here in Athens, and Andrew Benintendi he's a really fun hitter to watch. He's also a draft-eligible sophomore, which means that the leverage is definitely a little different. How confident are the Red Sox in being able to get Benintendi signed?
Yeah, I think they're going to sign the player. There's no doubt about that. I think Benintendi's really excited about coming to Boston. I think that, they wouldn't have made the picks. They weren't 100% confident they were going to be able to get him. And, it's not every day you can get the guy people consider to be the best college. The guy I think was the best college hitter in the country this year. You get him in the seventh pick of the draft. So I think that was they're pretty excited that they were able to get him there.
He's an interesting story because on one hand, he took a really big leap this year, and this is not a level he played at the previous year. On the other hand, the skills he has would seem to play up pretty quickly. He played in the best conference in the country. He showed tremendous ability to get bat on the ball, pretty good strike zone, nice defense, a pretty well-rounded player. Do they view this guy as potentially a fast mover through the system?
They do, and the thing about Benintendi is he did take a big jump this year, but he's not a guy that the Red Sox just discovered because he took a big jump. They've been on this guy for quite a few years, I think even dating back to high school. They've liked him for a long time, so they were really hoping to get him, and they did. So, yeah, I think they do think that he can, his approach is going to play pretty well, at the pro level.
And is he a center fielder long-term? I mean, I realize those things can change, but is the belief that he's a center fielder long-term?
Yeah, I mean, they hope so. I mean, the Red Sox, out of their first four picks, I think they took three center fielders with Benintendi and Jagger, I can barely say his last name, the high school kid out of California, and Tate Matheny. So they think all three of those guys can play center field, and that's what they're trying to do is just surround their team with as many guys as they can who at least have the athleticism to play up the middle. The thing about Boston is the Red Sox always want to have a right fielder who could kind of play defense like a center fielder. So it's almost like they want to have two center fielders because you need that at Fenway Park. So where it all shakes out down the line, they're not worried about that right now. But, yeah, they certainly think that Benintendi can play center.
We tend to focus on the first name. Who else from this draft haul should fans maybe be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, they're pretty pleased about I think they really like Tate Matheny actually. They think that he's a guy who's not spectacular at one tool, but they think that he can do a bunch of different stuff across the board. So they feel that, and they really feel that they found a lot of kids with good makeup. They feel that they didn't go quite as pitching heavy as they did in years past, but they feel pretty good about their position player. They got a kid named Tucker Tubbs, who they think is going to be a pretty good hitter. He's a first baseman. Got a great name, by the way, too. But, I think the Red Sox, every team feels good about their team coming out of the draft. We'll see how it all plays out, in the next few years. But I think that they're reasonably optimistic they're going to get some good players from this year's group.
Is there anything philosophically, strategically, organizationally that can be gleaned from the overall 3 days of Red Sox drafting?
Just the middle of the middle of the diamond talent. I mean, you look at what they did coming out of the gate with Benintendi. Then they took a catcher. Then they took two more outfielders, just trying to keep. And then one of the outfielders can also play short. He played shortstop in high school. So just trying to get as much middle of the order kind of talent. They feel that their pitching is in pretty good shape throughout the system right now. So they really prioritize position players, I thought, this year. Taking they didn't take a pitcher until the sixth round this year, which is the first time since 1992. The Red Sox waited that long to go with pitching. So just, you've seen the Red Sox struggle as an offense really the last 2 years. And, you know, you wonder how that kind of played into their philosophy this year, is really trying to put some good hitters in their farm system right now.
I will take a break on you, and we'll talk Major League now. Rick Porcello looked like he had gotten it together and looked like maybe he was the one guy in that Red Sox rotation who was going to kind of be, if not an ace, at least an anchor at the front. Lately, not so good. What's going on with Porcello recently?
Yeah, it seems to be one big inning in most of the starts, and he's just, you know, I wonder, too, about, you know, you got a guy who just signed a contract worth $20 million a year, and he's never been a guy that a lot of people have looked at as a $20 million a year guy. I wonder, you know, internally, kind of, he's trying to pitch better than Rick Porcello, and he's trying to pitch like, you know, a $20 million a year guy. And maybe just, you know, squeezing the ball a little too tight, trying to justify the contract. I think that happens sometimes. So I think that he just maybe needs to relax a little bit. And, you know, it's his first time pitching in a market like Boston. So I think maybe just putting a little too much pressure on himself. I think once he figures out that, hey, if I can just be the Rick Porcello I was in Detroit last year, you know, that's essentially the Red Sox. You know, the Red Sox would be happy with that right now. So I think that, again, I just think that maybe just putting a little too much on himself, and that's leading to some misfires.
You are better plugged in with David Ortiz than a lot of people. You are a bit of a poppy whisperer. How big a deal is it when he grouses like he did about sitting against a left-hander? Is that just an indication of a guy who's frustrated because he's not hitting? Is it an indication that maybe something's amiss there? Is it just David Ortiz having a microphone in front of him and not able to say nothing? Another guy who seemed to be getting it back together, Hanley Ramirez, got on a little tear there. Then he gets dinged up. Is this any kind of significant issue, or is he all fine physically?
He's got that spikiness to him because, you know, if he was just kind of defeated, like they took him out of the lineup, and he, you know, he was like okay with it, you know, maybe that would mean that he really thought that he was done and he couldn't hit anymore and couldn't hit at a high level. So I don't think it's such a bad thing that, you know, you want guys who want to play. You know, do you want them to infect the clubhouse with negativity? No, and I don't think that David does that or is doing it. I think he just kind of vented in that particular moment. Look, this guy is the ultimate competitor. He's highly frustrated with the way this season has gone for him so far. I think it's just more frustration with himself and with the situation. But I get the sense that he still has a pretty good relationship with John Farrell. I think John is very honest with the players. And I think David knows deep down, if you ask him at a good moment, he knows that once he starts hitting again, you know, once he starts hitting lefties again in particular, this isn't going to be an issue anymore. So, you know, I wouldn't read too much
into it.
It doesn't
seem like they have a whole lot of options. I mean, I guess he could move to first. Is there anything else they could do with him besides put him at first even after this year?
No, I think it's just, you know, he's been dinged by a couple hit by pitches and things like that, and no broken bones or whatever. And I think, you know, I think that shoulder is going to keep getting stronger throughout the year. I mean, the real concern with Hanley right now, Matthew, is that we talked a lot about the defense. I think people thought that defense in left field was going to come quicker to him than it has, and that he was going to be more ready to make that switch because he's always been, you know, so athletic. And it's really been a tough adjustment for him. And he's, you know, he's just still seems a little unsure of himself defensively. So they're just hoping they can get him through the year defensively right now. And to be quite honest with you, you know, I don't know if he's going to be a left fielder after this year. You know, I think that this is, like I said, it's not going as well as they hoped. So they just have to get through this year with him in left and maybe sort of reevaluate, you know, where they can play him going forward for the rest of that contract. It's just,
Ramirez was
like,
asked about
like
a move and dismissed it out of hand, but that would only be for this year. If somebody were to come up over the offseason and say, hey, let's revisit this, do you think he'd be open to that?
I still don't know exactly what's going to go with what's going to happen with Poppy right now. Where, I mean, he's got that thing. You'd think he'll get the 425 plate appearances where his $11 million will vest for next season, but that's still that's not a total slam dunk at this point. You know, you have an opening at first base, so whether that would mean convincing Pablo to move across the diamond and playing Hanley at third, whether that would mean, you know, certainly Hanley's played short at third. Certainly you would think that first would come a lot easier to him than left field has been. So I think that's an option, too. But, yeah, they're going to look at everything this winter, and that could be a creative solution to fill. It looks like the holder going to have a first base because, you know, Mike Napoli, we're sitting here, you know, he got that on that nice little hot streak a couple homestands ago, and now he's kind of back to where he's not hitting the ball again. So it doesn't look like he's going to be back next year, at least at this point.
Ramirez was asked about a move and dismissed it out of hand, but that would only be for this year. If somebody were to come up over the offseason and say, hey, let's revisit this, do you think he'd be open to that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that he would admit that he's more comfortable in the infield. The fact that he's I like the fact that he says, "Look, I want to stay in the outfield now," because he doesn't want to quit on it. You know, he made a commitment to them to be their left fielder, and he wants to at least try it through the season. Who knows? You know, maybe he'll make a big leap in the second half. I don't know. You know, it's still relatively early in the season here. Maybe in the second half he'll kind of turn a corner as a left fielder. But yeah, you know, right now it's sometimes painful on the eyes, I think, for a lot of people to watch Hanley play left field. I'm sure it's painful for him to make some of the plays or misplays that are happening out there.
This is MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.